supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Dave Heller has the night off. The U.S. Department of Justice today filed an appeal in a case against the city of Philadelphia over so-called sanctuary city policies. WHYY's Laura Benchoff is here with us now to discuss this development and to take a look back at what this term, sanctuary city, has meant in our region as President Trump approaches his one-year anniversary in office. Hi, Laura.
Hey, Mary.
So since the summer, Philadelphia and the Department of Justice have been battling in court over whether the city cooperates enough with certain federal immigration enforcement policies. What are those policies?
So the term sanctuary city or sanctuary jurisdiction doesn't really mean any one policy. But early in his term, President Trump issued an executive order directing the Justice Department to find ways to cut funding to those cities or places that it considered sanctuary cities. So what the Justice Department did this year is they said to Philadelphia, hey, in order to get these funds we normally give you, you need to prove that you share information with federal immigration enforcement, and you need to give us 48 hours heads up anytime you're going to release somebody that we've let you know we would like to arrest. And so the city sued over this, and Pedro Tulante, So the city sued over this, and Sozi Tulante, who is the city solicitor for Philadelphia, he explained to me how they were able to convince this judge, U.S. District Judge Michael Bailson, that they do share information with ICE.
The judge found that we already comply with that because we share information in various databases in various ways with the federal government, including ICE. And so ICE knows who's in our facilities.
Now, the Department of Justice is appealing that judge's decision.
So Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, can and does still operate in these cities. How easy is it for them to do what they do, Laura?
So ICE officials in statements and at press conferences have said repeatedly that it makes their jobs harder, that it's more dangerous for them to go out into a community setting to make arrests. But as you said, they do still make arrests here. And what we've seen from ICE's own numbers is that they are making more arrests, or they did make more arrests in budget year 2017 than the previous year. The most recent year, they made 5,000 arrests in an enforcement area that covers Pennsylvania, Delaware, and West Virginia. And the year before that, they only made 3,600. So that's a pretty significant leap. And in Philadelphia specifically, the agency publicizes when it has done stepped-up enforcement to target the so-called sanctuary jurisdictions. Like in September, ICE arrested 107 people in Philadelphia, and they called it Operation Safe City, which explicitly named Philadelphia and Denver and other cities across the country that they single out as not cooperating to the extent that they would like. And we're also seeing arrests happen at different places around the city. Bobby Allen, a colleague here at WHYY, did some reporting about how arrests are happening at local courthouses. And I should say that while a lot of attention is paid by the federal government to the idea that they're going after criminals, the numbers do show that we are seeing more people without a criminal record being arrested now.
With all of these arrests, can we call Philadelphia a sanctuary city? And who does use this term?
A lot of people use it. It's an easy shorthand, and I would say that the media uses it. Philadelphia officials do not use the word sanctuary. They prefer a term like welcoming cities. And the Department of Homeland Security uses it in its releases when it's talking about arrests that's made. And they use it to sort of imply that such cities like Philadelphia are harboring dangerous criminals. But at the same time, pro-immigrant groups also use the term. Shayla Quintana is a community organizer with a group called the New Sanctuary Movement, and she says they use the term as a kind of rallying cry.
It has mobilized a lot of people around it, and it has pushed cities to take stances when the federal government was targeting them and targeting their immigrant communities.
So as you can see kind of how both sides use this term differently, it's used sometimes as a slur or sometimes as a hopeful symbol, and it really depends on who you're talking to.
All right. Laura Benchoff, thank you so much for joining us for NewsWorks Tonight.
My pleasure, Mary.
The insurance giant Aetna has agreed to settle a lawsuit for $17 million. It involved a rather low-tech privacy breach, one that exposed HIV information of about 12,000 of Aetna's members. As WHYY's Alana Gordon reports, some recipients and lawyers from the Philadelphia region have taken a lead on the case.
Sam's jaw dropped when he got the letter from Aetna this summer. The envelope window was so big that he could see excerpts from the letter itself through the window, more specifically a reference to prescriptions for HIV. He was in his apartment building in New Jersey, and he looked around, a little paranoid about whether someone else might be able to see it.
You know, people say, like, when their social security number is disclosed and things like that, or there's a data breach, how they feel violated. I've been part of those things before, but I never really felt it. This, though, because it was, like, my private health. And because that forms an aspect of, like, my daily life, essentially. You know, every morning I get up, I take a pill, you know, to make sure that I don't spread something and to take care of my own health. Just to be exposed like that, I really felt vulnerable.
We're not using Sam's full name because he worries about how going public with his HIV status might affect his work. Also, his parents don't know. He was far from the only one who this happened to. Aetna's vendor sent the letter to upwards of 12,000 of its members who take HIV medications.
We believe this is the largest data breach of HIV-related information ever.
Rhonda Goldfein is director of the AIDS Law Project of Pennsylvania. In August, her office and several other legal aid groups started getting complaints from people who had received the letter. Some were really serious, because despite improvements in HIV treatment and the stigma that surrounds the disease, discrimination is still a reality. Goldfein heard from at least a dozen people who had to move after someone else saw the letter. One man, she says, found homophobic slurs painted on his door. Another woman, she says, stopped being able to function when people in her tight-knit immigrant community learned of her HIV status.
And she stopped being able to function, and she stopped being able to go to work, and she lost her job.
When they realized how widespread the privacy breach was, they sought class action status in a lawsuit. Now Aetna has agreed to a $17 million settlement. It's still pending a judge's approval. In a statement, the insurer said it's worked to address the potential impact of the unfortunate incident and that it's putting measures in place to prevent something like this from happening again. Each person who received a letter will get an automatic payment of $500 from the settlement. A separate fund will be set up for people to file for additional damages and costs. Bill McEverin says $17 million really stands out in the world of data breach lawsuits in general. He specializes in privacy law at the University of Minnesota.
That's a big settlement.
McEverin says the amount may be unusual, but low-level breaches like this are not. Companies may be so focused on IT security that they overlook some other ways that privacy can be breached.
There's so much attention to cybersecurity, and rightly so, but a lot of medical privacy concerns are much more analog than that.
For Rhonda Goldfein of the AIDS Law Project, reaching a settlement of this amount in just 4.5 months has been a relief to her client.
It was important for us to send a clear message to people with HIV that your medical information is important and that it will be protected and that we will take quick action to make sure that it's protected.
The original plaintiff in the case is a Bucks County man who, in the lawsuit, went by the pseudonym Andrew Beckett. It's a nod to the Tom Hanks character in the 1993 film Philadelphia, who was fired once his law firm found out he had HIV. But perhaps in a sign of all the advances in HIV since the film, the Andrew Beckett in this case doesn't actually have HIV. He's been taking the HIV meds as a form of pre-exposure prophylaxis therapy, or PrEP. It's an effective treatment to help prevent a person who may be at risk of being exposed to HIV from getting it. Alana Gordon, WHYY News.
It's been the first full day on the job for Phil Murphy, New Jersey's 56th governor. On Inauguration Day Tuesday, Murphy wasted no time in jumping in, signing an executive order to prohibit state agencies from asking job applicants about their prior salaries. He brings to the governor's office an ambitious to-do list, likely to please many in the Garden State's liberal constituency. What are the odds Governor Murphy gets what he wants? NJ Spotlight's John Breitmeyer is with us now to offer some insight. Hello, John.
How you doing? Hello.
So before we get to the list, let's talk about the tone Murphy has tried to set for his administration, a potent symbol, actually, that was used on Tuesday. He was sworn in using the Kennedy Family Bible. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this was a bit of a surprise. We didn't know this headed into the inaugural address that Murphy had arranged this with the Kennedy Presidential Library. So just as Murphy was being sworn in, he was introduced by his wife, Tammy, and she told the audience gathered in Trenton that this Bible was actually provided by the Presidential Library, and it was the same exact Bible that John F. Kennedy was used when he was sworn into the presidency some 60 years ago. And the speech itself that followed, you know, Murphy struck tones of optimism and unity and inclusion and spoke about some big themes that sort of had a Kennedy-esque feel. And he also quoted JFK and his brother RFK during the speech. So certainly someone that he looks up to.
So let's get to that to-do list. A $15 minimum wage. John, easier said than done, even with a Democrat-led legislature?
There is a little bit of tension, even though we have a situation in Trenton now where the legislature is controlled by Democrats, and the governor's office is now obviously controlled by a Democrat who wants a $15 minimum wage. The issue is there may be some details that have to be worked out, including how quickly New Jersey gets to a $15 minimum wage. Right now, the wage is set at $8.60. There's some debate in the legislature of how quickly you can move from $8.60 to $15 and how realistic that is for some businesses.
All right. Legalizing recreational marijuana, which would likely bring in hundreds of millions of dollars to New Jersey's coffers. Again, not necessarily a done deal. John, as you write, the legislature's Black Caucus is saying not so fast.
Yeah, this is another one of those issues where at the top line level, there's agreement. Murphy has brought up legalizing marijuana because New Jersey has a big disparity between the number of African Americans and whites when it comes to arrests for drug possession. They don't line up with what African Americans, whites tell pollsters their normal marijuana habits are. So Murphy arrives at his position largely from that disparity. That's also a concern for Black lawmakers in Trenton. However, they have some other concerns, and they don't want to see this policy rushed into place without going over a bunch of other issues, including what this could mean for increased rates of drug use in general, impact on communities of color in particular. And so they're asking for a series of hearings to be held throughout the state.
So Governor Murphy wants to raise some taxes on millionaires. And in his inaugural speech, he referenced those New Jerseyans who might be considering moving out of state, saying many years from now, when you look back, planting your flag in New Jersey will have been one of the smartest decisions you ever made. Do you think he was talking to wealthy New Jersey residents who are loath to see taxes go up?
Certainly he was telling New Jersey residents in that line, sort of stick with me and look at the big picture and everything I plan to do and then evaluate whether you think it's a good deal. But I can say there is definitely some concern in the legislature, even among Democrats, that this idea of hiking, and it would be a new top-end income tax rate only on earnings over $1 million.
All right, John Reitmeier of NJ Spotlight, great to have you with us.
You're welcome. I was happy to be here.
Getting pulled over by the police can be stressful, but recent high-profile incidents show that traffic stops can also be deadly. Philando Castile in Minnesota, Walter Scott in South Carolina. The national conversation is focused largely on retraining police. But in New Jersey, officials are aiming a new effort at the other side of that interaction, drivers. WHYY's Joe Hernandez has the story.
When you get pulled over by the police, you have to stay in your car. Everybody knows that, right?
We've spoken with teenagers who believed wrongly that if they're pulled over, the first thing they should do is get out of their car. No.
Ellie Honig directs the Criminal Justice Division at the New Jersey Attorney General's office. He's one of the people behind Safe Stop, the office's new public information campaign. Honig spent the last several years listening to the national debate on policing and racial bias among officers. As a result of that, he set out to make cops across New Jersey more accountable. That included giving out grants for thousands of new body cameras and updating the state's guidelines on investigating shootings by police.
And as we started to, you know, see some real success with that, we said, well, why don't we hit the other side of the equation here and educate the public as well?
Enter SafeStop. Honig says it's a way to teach the public stuff you might have forgotten from your high school driver's ed class or things you never learned in the first place. Things like turning on your dome light if it's dark out when you get pulled over, or the fact that after showing an officer your ID, you have the right not to answer any more questions. The campaign also tells people how to file a complaint against the police if they feel they've been mistreated. State officials have put all of this information up on their website, and they're also airing ads on TV and in movie theaters.
I want to talk about traffic stops.
Here's one with Montclair Detective Kim Nelson Edwards.
I've made plenty over the years, and I've been stopped myself. I understand how stressful they can be.
They even got former NBA center Shaquille O'Neal to appear for one of the videos.
Shaq here. Nobody likes traffic stops, but if there's a stop...
Megan Stroshine studies traffic stops. She's a professor at Marquette University in Milwaukee, and she says communication is often a factor when traffic stops take a turn for the worse.
Right, a lot of traffic stops start in a very mundane fashion, and then they escalate out of control because of those misunderstandings and miscues and misperceptions.
Stroshine says drivers and cops across the country have been more sensitive to civilian police interactions over the last few years. She says there have been efforts in other states to train drivers on how to behave during traffic stops, but they've generally come from grassroots groups working in high-crime, low-income neighborhoods where residents feel more likely to have a bad interaction with police.
So it has existed, but not in a formalized sense where the government is actually providing that information.
In New Jersey, the effort has wide support. Aside from the AG's office and other law enforcement agencies, groups like the State American Civil Liberties Union and the NAACP are on board. But there are some critics.
Well, I think that's victim blaming.
Walter Hudson runs the National Awareness Alliance, a social justice advocacy group based in South Jersey. He says it's a good thing for drivers to have more information, but it's unfair to put the responsibility for safe traffic stops on civilians and not on police officers who sometimes break protocol.
You know, we've seen traffic stops. You know, we could just Google it now. We have the World Wide Web open to it where we could see where people complied. They did the right thing, showed their credentials, and they still end up dead.
Hudson acknowledges that being a police officer is a tough job, and he says he tries to behave properly during traffic stops. But Hudson knows the officer has all the power during a stop, and as a black man, he still gets worried.
And I know myself, I'm nervous when I get pulled over because you don't know how that stop is going to turn out.
Ellie Honig with the AG's office says officers are being trained, but that doesn't mean that drivers can't play a role in keeping traffic stops from going awry.
The only thought here is let's educate as many people as are willing to be educated, and if that leads to safer stops, then wonderful. It's not about blame. It's not about politics. It's about safety, period.
From the New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
This week, a Bucks County school had a special visitor. Valley Day School in Morrisville enrolls students who've experienced trauma in their lives. So has singer-songwriter Sam Baker, who uses his guitar as part of his recovery. WHYY's Nina Feldman sat in on a music lesson and has this report.
Feeling alone can be a big part of dealing with trauma. But these students and their teacher have something in common.
Play something that your hands kind of falls out of your hands right now.
In 1986, Sam Baker was on a train to Machu Picchu in Peru when a bomb planted by a terrorist group exploded, killing many of his fellow passengers. Baker barely survived. After 18 surgeries, hearing loss, and learning how to use his arms and legs again, he found music.
When the bomb went off, you know, it flattened my lungs, and I was like, how do I describe that? And melody would come to me. There was something in melody, something in singing, that went to a different place.
Baker released his first album, Mercy, and has been touring ever since. Studies have found that arts therapy helps trauma victims by calming the parts of the brain that have been overworked in response to painful events. And it gives victims a chance to express what they're feeling without using language.
That is heart-wrenchingly beautiful. Oh my God.
This has helped for Andrew Hart, a student at Valley Day School and the self-taught guitarist, heard here. Hart is 16 and suffers from depression.
School is rough. I constantly get made fun of and bullied, and everything's just dark. But music, it's like medicine.
After his day with the students, Baker played a benefit show to support Valley Day School's artist in residency program. Nina Feldman, WHYY News.
Finally, whether it's wearing a favorite jersey, getting everyone into their assigned seats, or commuting with the ghost of Chuck Benarek, many of us have our Eagles game day rituals and superstitions. And come Sunday, we'll be doing our part to make sure the Birds win the NFC Championship game against the Minnesota Vikings. We want to hear what you'll be doing. Send a recording of you talking about your game day ritual to NewsWorks Tonight at WHYY.org. And just to get you inspired, here's Delaware Governor and Eagles superfan John Carney.
Fly, Eagles, fly.
And do you have any superstitions before a game? Is there anything you do?
Well, I need to have my Eagles gear on, that's for sure. And if things aren't going right, sometimes I'll take my hat off. It's going to be an exciting day, and I'm looking forward to it.
That's your prediction.
Go Eagles.
Thanks for that, Governor. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. And by the way, one antidote for our wintry weather is summertime dreaming. Many of us are in the midst of planning summer vacations, and we are following suit here at NewsWorks Tonight. On tomorrow's show, we'll talk with travel guru Rick Steves about the latest in travel destinations for the summer. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan for NewsWorks Tonight.